Chapter 106. "Well," apostrophe said the captain, "it's my belief as you'll know more about it pretty soon, if you don't keep a bright lookout. I can read your signals, my lad. You may go." Apostrophe, "Oh, I may go at once, may I, captain?" Apostrophe, cried Rob, exulting in his success. "But mind, I never asked to go at once, captain. You are not to take away my character again, because you send me off of your own accord. And you're not to stop any of my wages, captain." Apostrophe, his employer settled the last point by producing the tin canister and telling the grinder's money out in full upon the table. Rob, sniveling, and sobbing, and grievously wounded in his feelings, took up the pieces one by one, with a sob and a snivel for each, and tied them up separately in knots in his pocket handkerchief. Then he ascended to the roof of the house, and filled his hat and pockets with pigeons, then came down to his bed under the counter and made up his bundle, sniveling and sobbing louder, as if he were cut to the heart by old associations. Then he whined, "Good night, captain. I leave you without malice." Apostrophe, apostrophe, and then, going out upon the doorstep, pulled the little midshipman's nose as a parting indignity, and went away down the street grinning triumphantly. The captain, left to himself, resumed his perusal of the news, as if nothing unusual or unexpected had taken place, and went reading on with the greatest assiduity. But never a word did Captain Cuttle understand, though he read a vast number, for Rob the Grinder was scampering up one column and down another all through the newspaper. It is doubtful whether the worthy captain had ever felt himself quite abandoned until now, but now, Old Soul Gills, Walter, and Heart's Delight were lost to him indeed, and now Mr. Carker deceived and jeered him cruelly. They were all represented in the false Rob, to whom he had held forth many a time on the recollections that were warm within him. He had believed in the false Rob, and had been glad to believe in him. He had made a companion of him as the last of the old ship's company. He had taken the command of the little midshipman with him at his right hand. He had meant to do his duty by him, and had felt almost as kindly towards the boy as if they had been shipwrecked and cast upon a desert place together. And now that the false Rob had brought distrust, treachery, and meanness into the very parlor, which was a kind of sacred place, Captain Cuttle felt as if the parlor might have gone down next, and not surprised him much by its sinking, or given him any very great concern. Therefore Captain Cuttle read the newspaper with profound attention and no comprehension, and therefore Captain Cuttle said nothing whatever about Rob to himself, or admitted to himself that he was thinking about him, or would recognize in the most distant manner that Rob had anything to do with his feeling as lonely as Robinson Crusoe. In the same composed, business-like way, the captain stepped over to the dental market in the dusk, and effected an arrangement with a private watchman on duty there, to come and put up and take down the shutters of the wooden midshipman every night and morning. He then called in at the eating house to diminish by one half the daily rations theretofore supplied to the midshipman, and at the public house, to stop the trader's beer. "My young man," apostrophe said the captain, in explanation to the young lady at the bar, "my young man having bettered himself, miss." Apostrophe lastly, the captain resolved to take possession of the bed under the counter, and to turn in there o' nights instead of upstairs, as sole guardian of the property. From this bed Captain Cuttle daily rose thenceforth, and clapped on his glazed hat at 6 o'clock in the morning, with the solitary air of Crusoe finishing his toilet with his goatskin cap, and although his fears of a visitation from the savage tribe, McStinger, were somewhat cooled, as similar apprehensions on the part of that lone mariner used to be by the lapse of a long interval without any symptoms of the cannibals, he still observed a regular routine of defensive operations, and never encountered a bonnet without previous survey from his castle of retreat. In the meantime, during which he received no call from Mr. Toots, who wrote to say he was out of town. His own voice began to have a strange sound in his ears, and he acquired such habits of profound meditation from much polishing and stowing away of the stock, and from much sitting behind the counter reading, or looking out of window, that the red rim made on his forehead by the hard glazed hat sometimes ached again with excess of reflection. The year being now expired, Captain Cuttle deemed it expedient to open the packet. But as he had always designed doing this in the presence of Rob the Grinder, who had brought it to him, and as he had an idea that it would be regular and ship-shaped to open it in the presence of somebody, he was sadly put to it for want of a witness. In this difficulty, he hailed one day with unusual delight the announcement in the shipping intelligence of the arrival of the cautious Clara, Captain John Bunsby, from a coasting voyage, and to that philosopher immediately dispatched a letter by post, enjoining inviolable secrecy as to his place of residence, and requesting to be favored with an early visit in the evening season. Bunsby, who was one of those sages who act upon conviction, took some days to get the conviction thoroughly into his mind that he had received a letter to this effect. But when he had grappled with the fact and mastered it, he promptly sent his boy with the message, "He's a coming tonight." Apostrophe, who being instructed to deliver those words and disappear, fulfilled his mission like a tarry spirit, charged with a mysterious warning. The captain, well pleased to receive it, made preparation of pipes and rum and water, and awaited his visitor in the back parlor. At the hour of 8, a deep lowing, as of a nautical bull, outside the shop door, succeeded by the knocking of a stick on the panel, announced to the listening ear of Captain Cuttle that Bunsby was alongside, whom he instantly admitted, shaggy and loose, and with his stolid mahogany visage, as usual, appearing to have no consciousness of anything before it, but to be attentively observing something that was taking place in quite another part of the world. "Bunsby," apostrophe said the captain, grasping him by the hand, "what cheer, my lad, what cheer?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, shipmet, apostrophe, replied the voice within Bunsby, unaccompanied by any sign on the part of the commander himself, "Hardy, hardy." Apostrophe, Bunsby. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the captain, rendering irrepressible homage to his genius, "here you are. A man as can give an opinion as is brighter than Dimmon's, and give me the lad with the tarry trousers as shines to me like Dimmon's bright, for which you'll overhaul the Stanfall's budget, and when found make a note." Apostrophe, here you are, a man as gave an opinion in this here very place, that has come true, every letter on it, apostrophe, which the captain sincerely believed. Eh? Apostrophe, apostrophe, growled Bunsby. "Every letter, apostrophe," said the captain. "For why?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, growled Bunsby, looking at his friend for the first time. "Which way? If so, why not? Therefore." Apostrophe, with these oracular words they seemed almost to make the captain giddy. They launched him upon such a sea of speculation and conjecture the sage submitted to be helped off with his pilot coat, and accompanied his friend into the back parlor, where his hand presently alighted on the rum bottle, from which he brewed a stiff glass of grog, and presently afterwards on a pipe, which he filled, lighted, and began to smoke. Captain Cuttle, imitating his visitor in the matter of these particulars, though the rapt and imperturbable manner of the great commander was far above his powers, sat in the opposite corner of the fireside, observing him respectfully, and as if he waited for some encouragement or expression of curiosity on Bunsby's part which should lead him to his own affairs. But as the mahogany philosopher gave no evidence of being sentient of anything but warmth and tobacco, except once, when taking his pipe from his lips, to make room for his glass, he incidentally remarked with exceeding gruffness, that his name was Jack Bunsby, a declaration that presented but small opening for conversation, the captain bespeaking his attention in a short complimentary exordium, narrated the whole history of Uncle Sol's departure, with the change it had produced in his own life and fortunes, and concluded by placing the packet on the table. After a long pause, Mr. Bunsby nodded his head. Open? Said the captain. Bunsby nodded again. The captain accordingly broke the seal, and disclosed to view two folded papers, of which he severally read the endorsements, thus. Last Will and Testament of Solomon Gills. Letter for Ned Cuddle. Bunsby, with his eye on the coast of Greenland, seemed to listen for the contents. The captain therefore hemmed to clear his throat, and read the letter aloud. My dear Ned Cuddle. When I left home for the West Indies here the captain stopped, and looked hard at Bunsby, who looked fixedly at the coast of Greenland. In forlorn search of intelligence of my dear boy, I knew that, if he were acquainted with my design, he would thwart it, or accompany me, and therefore I kept it secret. If he ever read this letter, Ned, I am likely to be dead. He will easily forgive an old friend's folly then, and will feel for the restlessness and uncertainty in which he wandered away on such a wild voyage. So no more of that. I have little hope that my poor boy will ever read these words, or gladden your eyes with the sight of his frank face any more. No, no, no more, said Captain Cuttle, sorrowfully meditating. No more. There he lays, all his days, Mr. Bunsby, who had a musical ear, suddenly bellowed, in the Bays of Biscay, oh! Which so affected the good captain, as an appropriate tribute to departed worth, that he shook him by the hand in acknowledgement, and was fain to wipe his eyes. Well, well! Said the captain with a sigh, as the lament of Bunsby ceased to ring and vibrate in the skylight. Affliction sore, long time he bore, and let us overhaul the volume, and there find it. Physicians, observed Bunsby, was in vain. Eh, to be sure, said the captain, what's the good o' them in 200 or 300 fathoms o' water? Then, returning to the letter, he read on. But if he should be by, when it is opened, the captain involuntarily looked round, and shook his head, or should know of it at any other time, the captain shook his head again, my blessing on him. In case the accompanying paper is not legally written, it matters very little, for there is no one interested. But you and he, and my plain wish is, that if he is living he should have, what little there may be, and if, as I fear, otherwise, that you should have it, Ned. You will respect my wish, I know. God bless you for it, and for all your friendliness besides, to Solomon Gills. Bunsby. Said the captain, appealing to him solemnly, what do you make of this? There you sit, a man as has had his head broke from infancy aparts, and has got a new opinion into it at every seam as has been opened. Now, what do you make o' this? If so be, returned Bunsby, with unusual promptitude, as he's dead, my opinion is he won't come back no more. If so be as he's alive, my opinion is he will. Do I say he will? No. Why not? Because the bearings of this observation lays in the application on it. Bunsby. Said Captain Cuttle, who would seem to have estimated the value of his distinguished friend's opinions in proportion to the immensity of the difficulty he experienced in making anything out of them. Bunsby, said the captain, quite confounded by admiration. You carry a weight of mind easy, as would swamp one of my tonnage soon. But in regard o' this here will, I don't mean to take no steps towards the property, Lord forbid, except to keep it for a more rightful owner, and I hope yet as the rightful owner, Sol Gills, is living and will come back, strange as it is that he ain't forwarded no dispatches. Now, what is your opinion, Bunsby, as to stowing of these here papers away again, and marking outside as they was opened, such a day, in the presence of John Bunsby and Edward Cuttle? Bunsby, descrying no objection, on the coast of Greenland or elsewhere, to this proposal, it was carried into execution, and that great man, bringing his eye into the present for a moment, affixed his sign manual to the cover, totally abstaining, with characteristic modesty, from the use of capital letters. Captain Cuttle, having attached his own left-handed signature, and locked up the packet in the iron safe, entreated his guest to mix another glass and smoke another pipe, and doing the like himself, fell a musing over the fire on the possible fortunes of the poor old instrument maker. And now a surprise occurred, so overwhelming and terrific that Captain Cuttle, unsupported by the presence of Bunsby, must have sunk beneath it, and been a lost man from that fatal hour. How the captain, even in the satisfaction of admitting such a guest, could have only shut the door, and not locked it, of which negligence he was undoubtedly guilty, is one of those questions that must forever remain mere points of speculation, or vague charges against destiny. But by that unlocked door, at this quiet moment, did the fell McStinger dash into the parlor, bringing Alexander McStinger in her parental arms, and confusion and vengeance, not to mention Juliana McStinger, and the sweet child's brother, Charles McStinger, popularly known about the scenes of his youthful sports, as Charlie, in her train. She came so swiftly and so silently, like a rushing air from the neighborhood of the East India docks, that Captain Cuttle found himself in the very act of sitting looking at her, before the calm face with which he had been meditating, changed to one of horror and dismay. But the moment Captain Cuttle understood the full extent of his misfortune, self-preservation dictated an attempt at flight. Darting at the little door which opened from the parlor on the steep little range of cellar steps, the captain made a rush, head foremost, at the ladder, like a man indifferent to bruises and contusions, who only sought to hide himself in the bowels of the earth. In this gallant effort he would probably have succeeded, but for the affectionate dispositions of Juliana and Charlie, who pinning him by the legs one of those dear children holding on to each, claimed him as their friend, with lamentable cries. In the meantime, Mrs. McStinger, who never entered upon any action of importance without previously inverting Alexander McStinger, to bring him within the range of a brisk battery of slaps, and then sitting him down to cool as the reader first beheld him, performed that solemn rite, as if on this occasion it were a sacrifice to the Furies, and having deposited the victim on the floor, made at the captain with a strength of purpose that appeared to threaten scratches to the interposing Bunsby. The cries of the two elder McStingers, and the wailing of young Alexander, who may be said to have passed a peopled childhood, for as much as he was black in the face during one half of that fairy period of existence, combined to make this visitation the more awful. But when silence reigned again, and the captain, in a violent perspiration, stood meekly looking at Mrs. McStinger, its terrors were at their height. "Oh, Cap'n Cuttle, Cap'n Cuttle!" said Mrs. McStinger, making her chin rigid, and shaking it in unison with what, but for the weakness of her sex, might be described as her fist. "Oh, Cap'n Cuttle! Cap'n Cuttle, do you dare to look me in the face, and not be struck down in the hearth?" The captain, who looked anything but daring, feebly muttered, "Stand by." Oh, I was a weak and trusting fool, when I took you under my roof, Cap'n Cuttle, I was. Cried Mrs. McStinger. "To think of the benefits I've showered on that man, and the way in which I brought my children up to love and honor him, as if he was a father to 'em, when there ain't a housekeeper, no nor a lodger in our street, don't know that I lost money by that man, and by his guzzlings and his muzzlings." Mrs. McStinger used the last word for the joint sake of alliteration and aggravation, rather than for the expression of any idea, and when they cried out one and all, "Shame upon him for putting upon an industrious woman, up early and late for the good of her young family, and keeping her poor place so clean that a individual might have ate." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.